And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and joining me now is the original Ant-Man, Dr. Jack Longinot. Dr. Longinot is a prominent University of Utah biology professor and an ant expert who has discovered a multitude of new species. Dr. Longinot, welcome to This Green Earth.
It's great to be here.
I have so many questions. Ants are something that we generally run into on a day-to-day basis in certain times of the year, but I really don't know a ton about their biology and how they operate. So I am very curious and want to know more about this world. But first, let's hear more about you. How did you move in the direction of becoming a biology professor, and why specifically did ants enthrall you?
Well, it's great. You know, I was exactly in your position, about 40 years ago in a rainforest in Costa Rica, when I was standing around and, you know, ants were something everybody knew what they were, and everybody was interested in them and fascinated by them, but there actually wasn't all that much known about their biology, especially in that rainforest. And so I thought, gee, this would be cool. And so I decided then to become an ant expert, and I never looked back. So basically, I grew up in Florida. I started as a curious naturalist and a kid, you know, just really interested in bugs, and decided early on I wanted to be an entomologist, which is a scientist that studies insects, and went off in pursuit of career, and have sort of been all over the place with ecology and evolutionary biology, you know, and focused on tropical forest, on rainforests, and mainly in Central America. So I've had this career of sampling diversity, insect diversity, all through Central America, with this kind of specialty and focus on ants, because I thought they were so cool and they kind of run things in the rainforest. And then I've moved more and more into what's called taxonomy and systematics. It's kind of part of the ecology work, is needing to identify things. And I just got really fascinated with what that means and trying to figure out what species are and what their histories are. So in a nutshell, that's the background.
I can see how if you have this background and you're working towards this degree in entomology, how ants would be so fascinating. I remember being in Nicaragua and being on a hike, and the guide stopped us, and there was an army of ants, and it was almost looking like a conveyor belt. And I thought it was so fascinating. And, you know, he was very much cautious about telling us, you know, like, now be careful where you step because you don't want to disturb this. And I thought, wow, in that moment, they are this small insect, but they have such power over an ecosystem, and they are in multitudes underneath your feet. So let's start with their biology. And I believe is there like 12,000 different species of ants? So there's a lot of different types of ants. So when we break down their biology, are the species fairly similar as far as how they utilize their bodies, or are they all very different?
Ants in general, there are maybe about 13,000 officially described species in the world. And people estimate maybe twice that many, you know, are kind of out there, you know, kind of waiting to be figured out. There are a group of insects that have done very well in the world. They tend to be, you know, like so many groups, most diverse in the tropics. And so I can walk around a patch of rainforest in Costa Rica and find over 500 different species of ants. But I also like to look for ants wherever I go. And here in our neighborhood, say within Salt Lake County, you might be able to find close to 100 species of ants. The diversity is lower than what you find in the tropics, but still plenty here to entertain yourself. You know, we recognize big categories with different kinds of ants, and they will be really different and obvious to everyone. You know, there are big carpenter ants that you might find in rotten wood, and the great big ants. And then there, you know, when you go to the desert, you see these piles of pebbles, and these fairly large red ants that are out gathering seeds, and they do something very different. And you can see the ants fighting on our sidewalks in Salt Lake City, and they're these piles of tiny little black ants having their rugby scrums on the sidewalk. You know, so there are those sort of obvious differences. If you go up in the mountains here, you know, up in the conifer forest, you'll see these big piles of pine needles with these big black and red ants, you know, cruising over the surfaces. You know, that's a very different kind of ant. But then when you look, you know, for those different types, you go in and look at the details and you find out, oh, you know, there are actually maybe 5, 6, 10 different species that look a lot alike. And those, you know, at that level, it really takes an expert to sort of tell them apart. Hmm. And they may be behaving very similarly, but there have been these divergences over time where they're not interbreeding with each other. They're operating like as genetically separate species in the environment.
Is it true of most ants that they can carry maybe up to 50 times their weight? Is that true?
Oh, I'd love to talk about this in my entomology class. Why that is not so special. It's always put out there as, oh my gosh, these things, you know, they're incredibly powerful. They can carry so much more than their own weight. But what is really fun is the idea of scaling laws, of just thinking about how the world they live in is extremely different from the world we live in just because of size. Mm. And there is this relationship. And if you think about it, it sort of makes sense where as if you take an animal and just go from tiny and small and scale it up, you know, without changing any proportions, then the strength of the animal is going to go up as the square of the size because it's kind of cross section of muscle area. But the weight goes up as a cube. And so if you took an ant and made it our size without changing any proportions, it probably couldn't stand up, much less lift any weight. Mm. So just by being small, that gives everything the opportunity to kind of lift fantastic weights.
I see. And if we talk about their senses, how do they operate as far as how do they see, hear, feel? What does that look like for an ant?
Yeah, it depends on the ant. Ants can invest a lot in each individual worker. And they tend to have colonies with large workers, but small numbers of workers. And those workers are often very capable. And if they forage above ground, they have big eyes. They can see you. They can see the landscape. They can see landmarks. They can learn routes by those visual landmarks. But all ants rely very much on odors. They very much live in a chemical world. And so they have little tasters on their feet and on their mouth parts and on their little feelers on their antennae. And so they're constantly assessing the chemical world around them. And they do that to touch other ants and to tell whether they are nestmates or not, you know, to find food, to follow tracks of chemicals on the ground, to put out alarm chemicals to alert their fellow nestmates that there's danger and to get them all riled up and you know, kind of like responding to the alarm. So very much a chemical world. Other kinds of ants use a route where they make a large number of cheap workers. And often those kind of thousands or millions of very cheap workers do not have the same kind of level of sophistication. They may not be as visually acute or have quite as complex a sensory system. But overall, they can be quite aware.
And they're social, is that correct? You don't often see them just hanging out by themselves.
Yeah, you never do, but I mean, in terms of their society. So somewhere back in the Cretaceous period, about 130 million years ago, some ancestor ant evolved. And by all evidence, that ancestor was a social insect. And it made a little colony with sterile workers that did not reproduce and instead helped their mom raise others. And then all the descendants, you know, all the ants on the earth today are descended from that social ancestor. So in that sense, all ants in the world live in societies.
And how does that hierarchy, what's that function like? You talked about there were kind of these soldier ants that do all of these things, and it depends on whether they live above ground or underground. What happens with the hierarchy?
It's interesting, you know, the way to think of it, often it's sometimes it doesn't quite make sense to even think of it as a hierarchy. More often people think of an ant colony, a term that's used, as a superorganism, where different parts of that society have different roles, almost like different organs in a body. And so you wouldn't necessarily think of, you know, a hierarchy of kidneys versus your heart versus your brain, you know, in your body. And likewise, in an ant colony, you have the queen for all of the ants, bees, and wasps, that whole group. They're very female-dominated worlds. All worker ants are female. And the queen, you know, produces offspring that are mostly female, and all those offspring grow up to be either sterile workers or new winged queens when the colony is reproducing. And when the colony is reproducing, then the odd thing is that unfertilized eggs can grow up to be males. And so when a queen wants to make sons, make some male offspring, she produces some unfertilized eggs, and those grow up to be the males. So within the colony, the queen basically functions like the ovaries of the colony. She sits in the middle and lays eggs. And then the workers are like the rest of the body that are out there gathering food, bringing it back, feeding it to the larvae, the immature ants, and the colony, doing the excavating, all those routine tasks associated with colony life.
Hmm.
I mean, you mentioned soldiers. I mean, that's a phenomenon where with the multiple times in different parts of the ant tree of life, in which the workers have evolved to come in different forms. And so in some species, you get what's called a soldier cast, in which there's sort of two, in some cases, there's just two kinds of workers. They're the little ones, and then the big ones with big heads that are called soldiers. In other cases, you get sort of a continuous size variation. And the army ants you mentioned are like that, where you see a complete range of sizes from the tiniest little bitty ones up to great big soldiers with great big heads. And that's another approach to this, you know, variation within the workers.
And when you break down their body segments, do they all have that physical trait that they have the head, the thorax, and the abdomen, and then their little legs that take them around? Is that basically the makeup of their external structure?
So insects in general, you know, have this structure of head, thorax, abdomen. In general, they have antennae as these, you know, kind of the feelers on the front. Mm-hmm. And ants are no different. If you want to get into the details, for ants in particular, a characteristic of the body that is fairly distinctively ant-ish is that, you know, a lot of insects have a constriction, you know, that separates the thorax and the abdomen. Now, the ants have either two or even three constrictions that make a little waist. It's an extra segment that seems to separate the thorax and the abdomen. And in some of them, there are two of those, two little waist-like segments. And it gives the abdomen greater flexibility. In many cases, it lets them kind of point the rear end of their abdomen forward. And that's where the weaponry is. Mm. So they can twist this abdomen around, and the stinger is there pointing forward, or some other defense that comes out of the end of the abdomen.
And do they have two stomachs? Is that correct? Is that all species?
A lot of social insects have what's called a crop. You kind of call that a second stomach, but it's really like, you know, when, you know, the gut goes from the mouth to the anus, and at some point along there can be this, you know, kind of constriction and valve, and the front then becomes just a distendable bag that can hold a lot of liquid.
Mm.
Another detail is that adult ants can only consume liquid food. So whenever you see an ant picking up a cookie crumb to carry back to the nest, it cannot eat that cookie crumb itself. It has to feed it to the larvae, the immatures. They can chew up solid food. But the adults rely only on liquids. But in some cases, they can, you know, say they take in nectar from little nectar glands on plants, or gather what's called honeydew from aphids and related insects. They'll take that liquid and just fill the crop with it, fill this distendable bag. And then they can go back to the colony and regurgitate that. They can empty that crop out back through their mouth to other workers or to the larvae. But then for their own nutritional needs, they'll let some of those liquids go through that valve and go into the rest of the gut. But adult ants don't do any digestion themselves. So in that superorganism metaphor we talked about, the larvae in the nest kind of function as the stomach. So they have the digestive enzymes, they get food, solid food and liquid food, they can ingest it, digest it, and then they will regurgitate digested food back to the adult workers for their needs. So you really think of them as the colony stomach.
That's really fascinating. And such a fascinating world to see how they operate. I want to get into now their ecological place in the world and what they do for ecosystems. So overall, how are ants contributing to an ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little hard to be precise, like to say what exactly would happen if all the ants disappeared overnight, but they're so successful. They're a big part of the animal, it's called biomass. You know, the weight of the ants in a typical forest is higher than the weight of all the wild mammals and birds put together.
Wow.
And in terms of what they do, they're probably having this kind of large impact on other insects. So they are certainly scavengers. And so any dead or injured insects that fall to the ground, the ants immediately get them and eat them. They are going to be predators to an extent. So they are almost certainly influencing the abundance of some kinds of insects in the environment. But one of the major effects is what they do in the soil, is just their excavating activity. You know, that has a big impact on the movement of nutrients around in the soil and the aeration of the soil, just doing a lot of excavating.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see, like you said, they amass and they're such a wildly large part of our ecosystems around us, but they're relatively almost unnoticeable as they go about aerating the soil and this pest control or taking care of decomposing insects. It's like they're playing this massive role in what's happening around us, and yet it's really almost an unseen way in which they survive in our world. I have so many other questions about ants, but one of the things that I wanted to talk about, because it's been in the news as of recent years, and it's such a wild phenomenon, but the zombie ants and how they are being controlled by this fungus. It's just such a wild symbiotic story in nature. And can you talk me through the zombie ant phenomena?
It is such a bizarre thing, but it's not restricted to ants. I mean, there's a general thing of, you know, a whole kind of chemical warfare that goes on in which, you know, parasites, instead of just eating their prey, they can influence their behavior in some very subtle ways sometimes. You see that in, you know, there's certain parasites that can make grasshoppers jump into water, because and then their parasites hatch out into the water. There are all kinds of different stories like this, but the fungi, and these fungi have evolved to kind of tap into the nervous systems of different kinds of insects, altering their behavior, and it's particularly prominent in ants. It's like getting a bad cold and then having that cold do something really weird to your personality. So with the ants, if they get infected by this fungus, they'll run around being a normal ant for a while, but then when the fungus is sort of filling up the inside of the ant and getting ready to reproduce itself, it manipulates the nervous system and the behavior of the ant so that the ant, instead of running around on the ground as usual, will climb up onto the vegetation up to a high point, clamp itself, use its jaws to clamp onto a leaf, and then it dies. And then this fungus sprouts out of the body and makes little mushroom-like bodies that disperse the spores of the fungus. And so basically it's making the ant go up to a good spore dispersal spot to send out the spores. And it's been found in a lot of different ant species in different places. It's quite a bizarre phenomenon. It's kind of spooky to think
Right.
about, if these things can manipulate behavior that way, what other kind of more subtle behavioral things might be going on? What if our diseases are actually influencing our behavior in subtle ways? It's spooky to think about.
Yeah, that's a wild thought. I mean, even if you're just telling me about and describing in detail how this fungus does that, you get the little hair standing up on the back of your neck. It's such a wild, wonderful world that we're living in. So you have discovered several different species of ants, even here in our backyard in Utah. What drives you to continue this path of discovery with ants, and how many different species do you think are still out there that we don't know about?
To me, it's just kind of a great challenge, and it's sort of a puzzle to figure out what species are. I like to go places and collect ants and sort of gather specimens and then bring them back to my lab. And my lab is basically this gigantic ant collection. And then I have all these little specimens where I can look in detail at the shapes and sizes and what the surface on them and the hairs on them and all those kind of structural details. But I can also extract their DNA and look at DNA sequences to see is the degree of genetic divergence of different individuals. And so that allows me to make this sort of detailed map of biodiversity of a particular piece of the world that is the ants. So teasing apart what those species are, if you go to a place like Central America, where there has been less research over the centuries of kind of Western science doing this activity of describing species, kind of discovering and naming different species, it's pretty easy in Central America to find new things. And so I've been, trying to sort of make a detailed inventory of the species in Central America. And in that process, I've named over 300 species of ants where, these are things that I have evidence that they're separate from each other and they don't have names yet. And that's been much of my work. But I like to sort of get to know the ants wherever I am. The ants in the United States, there's still plenty of areas that aren't fully worked out, but they are certainly more worked out than in Central America because there are fewer species and there have been more people working for more time. But I like to collect ants wherever I go. And so when I moved to Utah 15 years ago, I started collecting ants in Utah and getting to know the species here. I was never expecting to find a new species here, much less in my backyard in Salt Lake City. It was one of the most bizarre things in my life was to go out one night in the backyard in suburban Salt Lake City and see this ant in our little vegetable garden that just looked like it didn't belong there. It was in a group of ants that I know well from other parts of the world, but certainly not from here. And I was just blown away. And I looked at it and when I first saw them, I thought for sure, this is an introduced species that's come in on some potting soil. Mm-hmm. And it'll be one of the species in the Eastern US or from somewhere else. But I looked at it and looked at the characters and compared it with all the other species of that group in the world. And lo and behold, it's its own thing. And it looks like it has evolved here and is native to here. And it's most closely related to a species that's known from southern Arizona. It was so weird to find a new species in my backyard.
And what unique trait to an ant in all of your studies have you found that was the most fascinating to you or the most interesting?
Oh, yeah. I clearly have a favorite story.
Yeah, tell it.
I work in rainforest and it gets hot and I like to go down to nice, cool little rainforest streams in primary forest where it's shaded and there are great big trees. In these little forest streams, they make little curves and they make these little vertical areas of vertical clay bank. They're just like a, maybe a 4-foot tall clay wall at the edge of the stream. And it turned out there's a whole set of ant species that like to nest in those clay banks in primary forest. And you look close and you see these little nest entrances. And this one group of ants I was studying, I saw that they had these very fancy little nest entrances in the, they had excavated in the bank. It was like a little alcove, and inside was almost a little pedestal-like thing with a flat, you know, dime-sized clay disc. And in the little entrance hole in the center of the disc that the workers would go in and out of. And I noticed when I first discovered these things that there was a little clay pellet sitting on the disc. I mean, this little pellet is no bigger than a period on a page. And I thought it was just a piece of dirt and flicked it away and, you know, looked at some other nest. And when I came back, the little pellet was back. The workers had put it there. And when I took it away, they would replace it.
Oh.
And then when I noticed, and it was just kind of accidental, sometimes I carry around a few army ants in a vial to live ones, because you can hold them up next to some nests of different ants in the rainforest, and they'll do what's called a panic evacuation. Or if they smell an army ant, they freak out and explode out of the nest. All the workers each grabbing a larva, you know, like getting the kids and running and running out and dispersing out. And waiting for the army ants to go through, and then they come back home. So I often, you know, test nests with these live army ants just to see if they'll do this. And I did that with these little ants in the clay bank. And I watched as a worker popped out of the little entrance hole, grabbed a pellet, and pulled it in and closed the door.
Oh.
So they basically use these pellets to close the door against army ants. And when I tried other kinds of ants, they didn't respond. And when I was messing with them, they didn't close the door. It was just army ants. And if I held an army ant up, just immediately pop, you know, they'd like plug in, like pulling a cork in and plug the hole. So that's the coolest thing.
Yeah. Another just incredible story of how the world is working around us every single day in these very intricate ways. It's biologists like you that are studying this and bringing this to light and helping us to understand the natural world a little bit better, not only the place of ants in it, but also our place in it. So I really appreciate you coming on This Green Earth and sharing more about the world of ants and that special story there, which is really, I think, indicative of the genius that our natural world is and how even the smallest of species have figured these things out. And on a day-to-day basis, all of this is going on around us. So thank you so much. It's Dr. Jack Longino, who is a University of Utah biology professor and an ant expert who has discovered a multitude of new species of ants. We appreciate you being part of This Green Earth today.
Well, I certainly enjoyed it, and I encourage everyone to go out and be a curious naturalist.